From high atop Rocky Road in Moab, Utah, it's KZMU News. I'm Molly Marcello.
On the program today, we have the weekly newsreel, where we check in with reporters on their latest stories from the Moab area. Today, we discuss an event celebrating the return of Glen Canyon as Lake Powell falls. We also talk about a determination related to allegations of illegal mining brought against the Cane Creek developers. And we discuss the state legislature funding a new nonprofit with a tie to that same development. Finally, we finish off with an update on the Moab to Monument Valley Film Commission, which is celebrating their 75th anniversary this year. Here's Sophia Fisher, reporter with the Times Independent, talking about the upcoming Glen Canyon event.
Yeah, it's coming to town next Friday, March 15th, and it's called Glen Canyon Rises. So it's this big celebration of the return of Glen Canyon as Lake Powell continues to drop.
So as you report, it's going to feature artists, musicians, and writers. What can we expect?
Yeah, it's going to be, a really raucous artistic evening, just kind of celebrating the return of this canyon. So there's going to be a photographer, Don Kish. So Don Kish is a photographer who brought a legendary camera to the returning Glen Canyon. This camera had actually documented the canyon before it was submerged by Lake Powell. So she'll be there talking about this photo project. In addition, Peter McLaughlin, a musician, is going to be playing some songs, and he has the guitar of Katie Lee, who is known as the goddess of Glen Canyon. Another musician, Jackson Emmerer, who's written music about the canyon. And then finally, writer Zach Podmore. He used to work for the Salt Lake Tribune, and he is about to come out with a book called Life After Deadpool, which is an exploration of, you know, the science around the return of this canyon.
So this is going to, as you said at the top, celebrate the reemergence of Glen Canyon. As far as, you know, I know, Glen Canyon has been trapped underwater since the creation of the Glen Canyon Jam and since Lake Powell filled to capacity. And now drought is affecting Lake Powell and the waters are receding. Mm-hmm. What is the status of Glen Canyon right now?
Yeah, it's still emerging. So it's, you know, it's been emerging for the last couple decades overall. And the runoff from last year actually did, you know, refill Lake Powell somewhat. So, you know, when I spoke with Zach and Don, they said that actually a lot of the places they'd seen did get resubmerged, but, you know, not to a dramatic degree. So there are still plenty of parts of the canyon that are coming out. There are still pretty high up tributaries that have been exposed for 1 to 2 decades. And you can really see cottonwoods and native grasses and other native plant species kind of reinvigorating a lot of these side canyons, which is really cool.
Wow. Anything else to say about what you talked with Podmore about?
Just an interesting note, I guess, from our interview together is that, you know, Zach said that he's been thinking about his book in a strange way as, quote, a positive climate change story. You know, of course, climate change is really terrifying. And he notes that there's a mega drought that we're experiencing in the Southwest. And it is a disaster, of course, and, you know, definitely imperiling the populations that rely on the on Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Powell for electricity and for water. But at the same time, there is this sort of silver lining almost to this drought in the fact that Lake Powell has dropped and we've seen the return of Glen Canyon as, you know, and it's sometimes called America's Lost National Park. So I thought that was just a really interesting point. And there's definitely this juxtaposition of kind of life and death in the event. For example, the book is called Life After Deadpool, and the event is called Glen Canyon Rises, which I noted in the interview other people might call Lake Powell Falls. So there's this interesting tension and push and pull that I think makes it a really interesting and should make it a very emotional event for people.
Glen Canyon Rises is taking place at 6 p.m. March 15th at Star Hall. And there are more articles in the Times Independent that we want to highlight in this week's edition. And there's two of them related to Cane Creek development. So where do you want to start us on this topic?
Yeah, absolutely. Further developments in this development saga. The first story has to do with allegations made that the development was conducting illegal mining on its property on Cane Creek Boulevard.
All right. Reorient us. Tell us where this project is happening.
Yes, it's on Cane Creek Boulevard in the Colorado River corridor southwest of town, just a mile or two out of town. There are 180 acres out there that are privately owned and a trio of developers right now are planning a project that could include up to 580 residential units and overnight accommodations units and up to 72,000 square feet of commercial space. The only work that's happened on the property so far, the only major work, I should say, has been earthworks. So the removal of infill from the mesas on the property, and that's being moved down to river-adjacent lowlands to bring them out of the floodplain. That's been happening since December.
Okay. And as you just mentioned, there had been several complaints that had alleged that the development had violated rules around mining, and it sounds like, according to a determination, that's not the case.
Correct. There were several complaints filed with Grand County in early February alleging that the infill, you know, removal and placement work constituted mining or the extraction of sand or gravel that, you know, these complainants alleged is illegal under the land use code within this zone, which is primarily highway commercial, though there is some range and grazing. But a March 1st determination from Grand County closed those complaints, saying that there was no violation.
Okay, so this determination came from Grand County Compliance Officer Brandon Black, is that right?
Correct. Kind of the crux, I feel like, of Black's determination had to do with the difference between like a primary or a principal use versus an accessory use. Mm-hmm. So if you do go into the county's land use code, it does say that, you know, mining is not permitted within highway commercial, and that the extraction of sand and gravel also does not appear to be permitted within highway commercial. But first of all, actually, the work is not considered mining because under state code, the extraction of sand or gravel or infill is not mining. So that puts that allegation to rest. But in terms of the sand and gravel extraction, though, it appears to not be permitted. There's a difference between what's called a principal or primary use and an accessory use. So an accessory use is something that kind of helps somebody fulfill a primary use, if that makes sense. So the extraction of sand or gravel would not be permitted if it were, say, just on its own or for a commercial purpose, say being sold. But it's not for a commercial purpose, or at least it's not being sold. And Black wrote that the earthwork is supporting the primary use, which is development. So therefore, it's actually permitted as kind of a just a subsidiary activity almost.
All right. There's more news related to this King Creek development. This has to do with a nonprofit that is currently being led by one of the developers of that King Creek project.
Yeah. So on the last day of the general session, the legislature approved or, you know, kind of codified $1 million of funding to a fledgling workforce housing nonprofit for which Craig Weston, one of the Cane Creek developers, is the executive director.
Okay. So one of the developers is involved in Utah Workforce Housing Advocacy, the nonprofit that was awarded this funding.
Yes, exactly. He's listed as the executive director, and he originally made a request for $2.5 million in funding. A subcommittee downgraded that to $200,000, but then it was bumped back up about a week before the end of the session to $1 million. There really is little to no public presence of this nonprofit online. It's just a couple of months old. And unfortunately, certain recordings were missing from the legislature's website, and I haven't been able to obtain those from legislative aides. But there was, you know, a short description of the organization online that said it's primarily intended to do outreach to, you know, educate Utahns about existing programs around home ownership and affordable or attainable housing. I also spoke with Steve Waldrop, who is I found out is actually quite intimately involved in the organization as well. Waldrop is a former state legislator who last year was named as Governor Spencer Cox's senior advisor for housing strategy and innovation. Mm. Waldrop said this organization, Utah Workforce Housing Advocacy, wants to change the narrative around growth and density in the state. You know, in certain places in the state, I would say particularly on the Wasatch Front, there's a lot of animosity to any sort of new growth, even though that could, you know, expand housing options for people. And he said this organization mainly aims to combat that.
Now, as you point out in this reporting, you know, this nonprofit is 3 months old. So others have found that unusual for the state legislature to give such a large amount of money to a new organization. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. And before I'd spoken with Waldrop, I talked to Caitlin Myers. You know, she's a Moab resident. She is a Moab City Councilor and the executive director of the Moab Area Community Land Trust, though she clarified that she's not speaking on behalf of those groups. But she has quite a bit of familiarity with, you know, housing loan and grant funds in the state and how to obtain money for housing programs. And she said to, you know, obtain $1 million in funding, you'd usually have a lot of regulations to comply with, a lot of hoops to jump through. Mm-hmm. And she called it frustrating and perplexing that this new group with no track record and, you know, almost no information online mm-hmm. was granted $1 million kind of just like that.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, you spoke to Steve Waldrop, who's a former state legislator who was named as a Governor Cox's senior advisor for housing strategy and innovation. But I'm also curious about, you know, what the goals and objectives are for Utah workforce housing advocacy for that funding. And it sounds like we don't know that yet.
He did say that the money will be subject to full and complete accountability measures. You know, it'll produce public data. He said, quote, this won't be anything that's hidden or secretive at all. And also said the group has raised $250,000 privately. So he said they're actually aiming to have a pretty good balance of public and private dollars. You know, the money is going to go towards their mission, but I don't think he had a ton of information yet about specifically what it would fund. He's also building a couple of different policy and kind of executive boards for the organization. So there will be more people involved than just Weston, although he is, you know, essentially the most public facing member of the group at this point.
All right. There is more information in Sophia's article in the latest edition of the Times Independent. And finally, Sophia, you have some news related to the Film Commission.
Yes. It's a big year for the Moab to Monument Valley Film Commission, or as Commissioner Biga Metzner has started calling it, the Thelma and Louise to Forrest Gump Film Commission. It's pretty cute.
It's very funny.
First of all, they are celebrating their 75th anniversary this year, which is the same year as the 100th anniversary of film in Utah. So there are going to be events coming up at the Grand County Fair and hopefully in the fall as well to celebrate that. In addition, Horizon, An American Saga Parts 1 and 2, which were largely filmed in Grand and San Juan Counties, are being released this summer. Metzner said she's working really hard to make sure they come to Moab in some form.
I could see Metzner taking on some sort of, you know, premiere in Moab.
So it's funny, we talked about the word premiere, and apparently premiere comes with a lot of specific regulations and requirements. So we're calling it a screening, but she does want to have a screening for cast and crew and everybody here who was involved, because there are dozens of Moabites who are involved in the production.
Amazing. And then there's also, as you report, an incentive for films that was passed in the legislature.
Thank you for bringing that up. HB 78, which basically makes permanent a tax incentive for rural specific film productions, that passed the legislature on one of the last days of the session, which is really big news for Metzner and everybody else who deals with films in rural Utah.
So what does that mean for filmmaking in our area?
Yeah, well, in the immediate future, it means that, you know, films that prove that they're spending a certain amount of time filming in rural Utah, which certainly includes, you know, Grand and San Juan counties, it means that those productions can continue applying for a lucrative tax incentive or tax rebate that'll make it much more attractive for them to film here, which could be big news for the local economy.
So an exciting year for the Moab to Monument Valley Film Commission, or as Biga Metzner says, the Thelma and Louise to Forrest Gump Film Commission, yeah. And probably now to Horizon Film Commission.
Yeah.
Thanks, Sophia.
Yeah, thanks.
Sophia Fisher, reporter with the Times Independent. Find more stories at moabtimes.com. You can find the pieces that were mentioned today in the show notes on our website, kzmu.org, or wherever you listen to the KZMU News podcast. As always, thanks for tuning in and supporting KZMU, community-powered radio.